Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today from Three Girl Theater, I'll talk with playwright Lee Brady as well as lead actress Megan Wicks about Southern Lights, a bluesy Texas in July tale of true love gone bad, success and betrayal. I'll also talk with cast members of the ACT production of Charles Dickens' classic, A Christmas Carol. Guests are Catherine Castellanos, who plays the ghost of Christmas Present, an ensemble member, Caleb Lewis, who dons a number of hats. Open Air's regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson explores history in the movies. Two new releases reveal different truths about two English-Scottish queens, Mary, Queen of Scots, directed by Josie Rourke, and The Favorite, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, on the behind-the-scenes politics between two cousins jockeying to be court favorites during the reign of Queen Anne. More from Peter Robinson, as well as some holiday suggestions from him and myself before the hour is out. Stay with us if you can. Picking of Peppino D'Agostino and the open-air theme guitar, we go to the stylings of Hank Williams, an unusual way to start a program that's very heavy on holiday shows here for Open Air. But to change your perspective, head on down to Z Below, where Three Girls Theater turns the space in the Mission into an intimate down-home East Texas bar to tell a bluesy tale of country music, true love, success, and betrayal, in a brand-new revival of Southern Lights, first produced by Theater Artists of Marin back in 1993. It's written by Lee Brady, directed by Andrea Gordon, with musical direction by Robert Bifus. And the play tells the story of Callie Callender and Lon McGee, the daughter and adopted son, respectively, of country music legend Cash Callender, when Callie and Lon's passionate teenage love affair was shattered by a very public tragedy. Playwright Lee Brady's professional theater resume runs some 10 pages, so we're not going to spend the entire hour on that. For nearly 50 years, she's been writing, acting, teaching, producing, and directing. But I understand she considers herself to be first and foremost, well, an award-winning playwright. She is resident playwright literary director for the Fearless Minds Production Company in Carmel Valley, a founder of Fresh New Works in San Francisco, teaches down at the Monterey Peninsula College, and is also an active theater critic. Her work has been produced in Edinburgh, Scotland, and San Jose, Costa Rica, as well as in regional theaters throughout the country. Here, in addition to her playwriting awards, Lee was honored for her achievements as a remarkable woman of the theater in the Unitarian Universalist Church of Monterey's Remarkable Women series. Lee Brady, welcome to our open airwaves.
Thank you. Well, you've got all that information. It's
lies? All lies? Fake
all
news?
All lies. All lies.
Fake, is it fake news? Fake news.
Fake news, yeah. But thank you. I'm glad to be here and to talk about Southern Lights, and which is, I have to say, though, Hank Williams is a little ancient for us. This is like, I always say it's for people who don't really like country music. Southern Lights is just...
All right, I'm there. Good. Okay, good. Actress Megan Wicks is also joining us. She plays Luann Callender in the production, is in an East Coast transplant who has been performing in the Bay Area for just over 2 years now. She studied at the Stella Adler Studio in New York and completed a residency at B Street Theater in Sacramento before moving out to San Francisco. She recently won a Broadway World Best Actor Award for her work in The Speakeasy as Velma Louise Cole, where she was here talking about that production some 2 years ago. Megan, welcome back to Open Air.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, let's start with our playwright, Lee Brady. The inspiration for creating this work, Southern Lights.
Oh, it was Greek. I think it was a period when I was doing a lot of Greek stuff and the myths. And there's a myth about a goddess who comes down to the world, and because this young person is not doing what he should be doing, and she changes his life, and they fell in love, but of course she has to go back to Mount Olympus and leave him sad. So that was
from Mount Olympus, we end up in Texas. Okay, I think you need to jump ahead a few years.
I'm from Oklahoma, so the Greek myths are very exotic to me.
Does the wind come whipping around the plane there?
Yeah.
So if I interrupted you, please go on about the myth connection.
That's just sort of it. And I wrote it, and then it just sort of became a musical, and it just sort of grew as plays do. Here it is, 25, 30 years later, and we're doing it again. But it's it's so totally different. Theater is so totally different every time you do it that it has, Megan and Pam are just... Number one, they're so young. And they sing so beautifully that it's their show. It's not my show.
Nice. Megan Wicks, when did you first come across Lee Brady's work?
I mean, this was the first play that I had ever read by you. I met you at the audition. And I was excited about this show because I wouldn't call it a musical. It's more like a play with music. The music all makes complete logical sense. And I personally prefer to do shows like that, so I was really into it. I'm also from Florida, which some people would not consider the South, but I absolutely do, North Florida.
Yeah, I was going to say, Panhandle.
it's the South, okay? So I have an affinity towards Southern pieces. The last show I did was The Arsonist at Capitol Stage, which was another two-person show, also taking place in Florida, so I guess I'm typecasted. Hmm. So that was the first time we met at the auditions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your character, Luann Callender.
So I actually play two characters. The first and the main one is actually Callie.
Oh, okay.
And then also I play Luann, so we kind of switch between two worlds. I would say Callie is a very, very sassy Southern girl. She's really opinionated. She's really passionate, and she's super driven, but she's also really lost. And I think this is the exploration of her at her most lost point.
Yes.
Trying to find herself again at the Crossroads Bar, quite literally, at the Crossroads.
Yes.
Yeah, very well named. She's spunky, but she's a little bit lost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Lee said that the play was inspired in part by Greek myth. Are you getting that connection somewhere, or are you just inspired by the story?
That's the first time I ever heard that. So. I love
so
it.
So much for dramaturgy.
We'll be channeling that this weekend. Come and check it out.
No. It's just if whatever starts you off doesn't always lead to where you think you're going.
But I do see it. I do see it, how someone comes down, changes your life, and then disappears.
Needs his life changed. Young Lonnie does, and you do change his life.
Well, I guess we can tie that into our holiday theme thing. I mean, It's a Wonderful Life is sort of like that. Right? Someone's coming
life
down
is
to
like
help.
That, isn't it? Yeah. If we're lucky. Yeah.
So this was first done back in Marin in 1993. Is it essentially the same show, or were there changes that you made?
Rather. At that point, we had two actors playing four characters. The young people play their parents, and all four of them are country music performers. So that's why how the music comes in, because that's who they are. But their parents kind of ruined their life in a way when they were young, and now they are sort of
trying to deal with it.
Pay the piper, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
right. But yeah. So the young people play their parents and do their parents' songs. So it's really interesting because it's a whole another character they're playing. They just move in and out on this small stage, and just totally believable. And and not confusing at all, or it doesn't appear to be. Yeah.
That's good. I'm glad it's not confusing.
Megan, tell us a little bit more about the journey of your characters and how you juxtapose the two of them.
Yeah, I actually really love playing Luann. I think she is so fun. She is Callie's mother. So we switch kind of between Callie, who is the main character, and then Luann, her mother. I like going into like a really deep Southern Texas woman, and she's very stifled.
I think you need to give us some of that accent now, if you would.
Oh my God. Okay, well, let's see. She's like, what does she say? Oh, Cash, what have you done to me, Cash? I'm so lonely, sitting here waiting for you. You know, she's really dramatic, and so I love playing her. And Callie's a little bit more modern. I think, you know, she lives in the current day, so yeah, of course she has an accent, and she's living that sort of Southern slow life, but she has some more modern qualities too. So I really like playing Luann. She's fun. But yeah, it's really fun to get to experience two people in one play, in one 1 hour, 20-minute play. I get to be two entirely different people.
Right. Well, you very generously offered to sing us a number live in studio.
I did?
Great. Okay,
you're stuck
great.
With it now, baby. Right. So set us up for the tune that you're going to sing.
So this song is called Southern Lights. That's also what the play is called. And this is just sort of a reflection on her time at home and just noticing how beautiful it is to be home again.
Accompanied by the KALW Orchestra, otherwise known as CD Player Number 1.
Ah, yes.
Oh, God, it's good to be home again, to feel those things I felt as a child. The sights and the sounds bring it all back to me. I'll miss those southern nights lit by southern lights and you. The fallen stars drip like candles, and mimosa air is so fine. You're sleeping here so peacefully. I hear your soft moan from time to time. On the seventh day when God rested, I'm sure he came down south for a while. The beauty I see, serenity I'm feeling. I'll miss those southern lights lit by southern nights and you. Oh God, it's good to be home again, to feel those things I felt as a child. Sights and the sounds bring it all back to me. I'll miss those southern nights lit by southern lights and you. I'll miss those southern nights lit by southern lights and you.
Wow, Megan Wicks, such beautiful singing.
Oh, thanks.
Who are we hearing on guitar?
That's Bob, who's our music director. He's playing a little accompaniment there. Yeah, he's an amazing musician, and he plays live during the show, as well as two other amazing musicians. We have a mandolin player. It's a real country swing band. This song specifically is kind of lighter and more of a ballad, but we've got jazz numbers.
Oh,
we've got
she has
full
a
blown
wonderful thing called Login for Texas.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Login for Texas Blues, which is just like, oh, boy.
I'm a blues singer by trade and jazz singer naturally, so singing Southern or country music is really strange to me. It is definitely not what I'm used to, but it's a really cool challenge.
Yeah, it is.
Wow. Well, Lee, what do you hope that people come away with when they leave the theater?
Well, I hope they feel rewarded by just the joy that is on stage here, and this and with the sadness and the, you know, the ups and downs. I have to say, at some point you realize this show is nothing more than a country song. It goes through all the country music tropes. Yeah,
it does.
And I hope they they'll probably come away singing these songs in their heads, because we've been doing that for like a month now. We can't get away from their wonderful songs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have to say, Bob Bifus, our musical director, was the original director in Theater Artists of Marin.
Oh, wow, back in 93, yeah. That's fantastic.
He knows what he's doing.
I guess so, and writes and plays some beautiful music. Musical direction by Robert Bifus, written by Lee Brady, starring my guest Megan Wicks along with Cameron LaBrie. It's at Z Below through the 22nd, Southern Lights by Lee Brady. Thank you both for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Happy holidays to you. Well, speaking of the holidays, A Christmas Carol is a cornerstone of the ACT repertory and has become a holiday tradition. Some 1,200 times it's been performed to a collective audience of over 1,180,000 and has employed more than 1,900 actors and 750 backstage staff members, a gift that truly does keep giving. As it did for Charles Dickens himself. First published in 1843, it was written in a period when the British were exploring and re-evaluating past Christmas traditions, having been previously tied by the Puritan no Christmas celebrations at all. So perhaps now they were considering including carols, a festive dinner, newer customs such as, a Christmas tree. A Christmas Carol has never been out of print and has been translated into several languages. The story has been adapted many times for film, stage, opera, and other media. It's a big source of income for Dickens was his public readings, including two tours of the U.S., the first back in 1842. And he was greeted like a modern rock star, a reaction that soon soured him to this country, including one recollection from Cleveland when he awoke to find, quote, a party of gentlemen staring through his train cabin window as he and his wife lay in bed. "If I turn into the street, I am followed by a multitude," Dickens later complained in a letter. "I can't drink a glass of water without having 100 people looking down my throat when I open my mouth to swallow." Then there were the less-than-English table manners he encountered here, and in Washington, with an enduring memory of the city being the tobacco-spitting he saw in the streets, quoting, "Washington may be called the headquarters of tobacco-tinctured saliva," Dickens fumed in American Notes. "The thing itself is an exaggeration of nastiness, which cannot be outdone." By the way, if you're in New York around the holidays, do try to visit the Morgan Library. They have a wonderful display of one of the original versions of A Christmas Carol, replete with all of Dickens's cross-outs and re-entries. And there's an exhibit about Dickens in America, including one of the original stands he used on tour. But back to the theater we go with my guests for ACT's production, Catherine Castellanos, who returns to her third Christmas Carol at ACT, where she made her debut as Church Lady in Between Riverside and Crazy. She's been seen in recent productions of Mother Road and La Commedia of Errors up at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and where she has appeared for several seasons. She's also an associate artist with Cal Shakes, where she has appeared in many productions and has been a company member with San Francisco-based Camposanto since 2001. She's taught restorative justice through theater arts with formerly incarcerated young women at Community Works West and Rising Voices, and with the men at San Quentin. She is the ghost of Christmas Present in this production. Catherine, thank you for haunting our studios today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
She's joined by Caleb Lewis, who dons several hats for this production, including the role of Thomas, Giles the Fiddler, and Businessman Number 4. Caleb's in his year 3 of the MFA program at ACT, one of 12 MFA actors in the production, many of whom earn their coveted Actors Equity card as a result. Caleb comes to ACT with a BA in philosophy from Georgetown University. Well, welcome to the heady stuff you will be bringing to these roles, Caleb.
Yeah, I'm always you think a lot, don't you? No, that's definitely me, so happy to be here.
Well, this is quite a production, as I said in the introduction. More than a million people have seen a version of ACT's A Christmas Carol, so you're now part of an incredible legacy that's going on. Is this your first dip into A Christmas Carol? I'll start with you, Catherine.
No,
this is your third, right?
Yeah, it's my third.
What was your other roles before
A Christmas Present.
Oh, really?
I'm always present.
You are.
Well, at least there.
Are you going to go for a James Carpenter run?
Oh, wouldn't that be fun, right? Yeah. I'll shove him out of the way and do Scrooge, maybe.
he's such a mainstay of the production for
so
many
fantastic.
Years. He's also alternating, by the way, with Anthony Fusco, who is also in the role of Scrooge for some of the performances. Because James has said this is just such a workout of a production.
It really is.
So tell us about your preparation for Christmas Present.
Well, the season just sort of catapults me into it. And we have how many in the Youth Conservatory? There are kids between the ages of 8 and 13 or something. Mm-hmm. There are over 24 of them. And so they kind of push me into the playing field, too, whether I like it or not.
Mm-hmm. But they bring an enthusiasm, too, which I'm sure
they really
welcome.
Do. They really do. No, they're wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to have in my life at this time, because Christmas Present is just to invoke joy and generosity and abundance and compassion. And so I try to make a walk through before I get to Union Square, to walk through some of the neighborhoods that are living a bit more on the margins, and try to bring that cheer in any way I can.
If anything can be described as Dickensian, it's San Francisco right now.
Yes.
You know, it's really amazing. The best of times, worst of times, to quote another Dickens.
Yes.
It is sobering walking through the Tenderloin on the way to ACT.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you bring a little bit of that to the stage.
I hope.
Caleb, donning several hats in this production. Tell us about your roles.
So I'm pretty much going to be found in both the past, present, and future. In the past, Giles the Fiddler. In the present, Thomas, which is at Fred's party. Fred is Scrooge's nephew. And to me, that's one of my favorite parts of the show, even when I watch it, just because, I think Fred, out of more than anyone, kind of is like the living embodiment of the ghost of Christmas Present. You know, that he just does what he can to bring the joy, and he's just so forgiving to his uncle, and so it's kind of fun to like follow the arc of the show throughout. You know, and then in the future I'm one of the businessmen. You know, and to get to help embody that and see that through, and I don't do what Anthony and James do. You know, they're on stage for an hour and a half more, but I do get to feel like I kind of take a bit of the ride with them, and that's definitely a pleasure to do. It's just kind of exciting to be on this stage with these amazing actors and hopefully learn a little bit from them.
Well, tell us a little bit about what it's like in the MFA program. What is the whole experience like beyond A Christmas Carol?
Yeah, so it's been an amazing ride. It's our third year now, and what's exciting about it is it starts really small. At least for us, it did. Our first thing in the first year was in just a studio in 9A, and so to go from there to being on the big Geary stage with 1,000 seats is amazing. And the way that it works is the way they evaluate us is called ACT readiness. When I got here, it was just called Geary readiness. But with the Strand opening up, they kind of have expanded that. And the idea is that they look, with the training and voice and speech and physical theater, they're looking to see, can you carry a story on not just the big stage now, but on smaller stages? Can you adapt? And to me, this has always been a very almost new school institution, because there's a lot of other, schools who are very much like, this is the type of acting that you're going to follow. But what I loved about ACT is the community, especially, but that it's more about, hey, as an actor or an artist, what are your strengths? What are you interested in? And, you know, so there's still definitely, you know, a lot of things that kind of go without saying, but of course, this is the basis. But they kind of, you know, give you a lot of room to say, hey, this is my voice as an artist. And I think what's been really exciting about this show in particular is, you know, I've worked with Dominique a couple times in the run of the in my time here, but to see her work with professional actors has been a very great learning process. Mm-hmm. You know, because she just kind of gets a bit more of that edge, a bit more of that efficiency, you know, and that's really exciting to see, like, hey, what's kind of expected of you, you know, when you're no longer a student and you're actually a professional actor, you know. And, you know, I'm a little different than the rest of my class. I came straight from undergrad. Some of my classmates were already equity before coming in, and that's been its own learning process too.
Mm. Let's speak a little bit about the direction of Dominique Lozano. James Cameron mentioned that he learned a lot from her direction that he hadn't learned before as Carpenter. James Carpenter.
James Cameron.
He's in the production too.
Who has Dominique worked with?
but tell us a little bit, Catherine, about what Dominique brought to the table for you.
Oh, Dominique and I, we've worked on both sides. We've acted together at Cal Shakes for many years before she was my director. And so we have a shorthand in language, and we talk a lot about it, not only at the theater, but then through texts and through meals and things like that. You know, work gets done. She has a very generous heart, and I mean muscularly, in directing this show. A generosity in mind as well. And so she's always looking for things to be expansive, and we can come up with ideas, but then she wants them to really balloon out, right? She is always interested in... I mean, I've been doing this for 3 years, and you know, there was a considerable shift in our country a couple of years ago, which changed the rehearsal room a bit, right? And who is Scrooge, and what is Scrooge, and how do we tell the story of Scrooge, and can Scrooge be changed? This year, it's been a much rougher ride. Mm. We can't make that complete parallel. She and I talked about that. We can't make that complete parallel anymore. So what is it now? You know, how do we forgive that?
You know, it's interesting you should say that, you know, thinking about these times, of course. But just to think in a literary way about some of these classics that we've come to know and love, we don't think of the character as their transformed self. We think of them as their original. You say the Grinch, and you're like, oh, the Grinch. And you say Scrooge, oh, Scrooge. You don't realize that by the end of the play, they're completely different people.
Right. It's
actually could be a compliment to be called.
Exactly. It could be, right?
Yeah.
But we use the verb of it instead of the transformation of it, mm-hmm. right? Because Christmas Carol is really about forgiveness and finding abundance and making room in your heart and being able to be forgiven, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she really... invokes that in the room, and I personally feel I love being directed by her. She listens to ideas. She listens to new ideas. Mm. It's not just about going in and, okay, I'll fit into this big thing again and go on stage and she keeps listening to new and fresh ideas and always has the ultimate plan in mind. That's what I love in a director, where they have the big eye, but they need your ingredient in the room to make the whole.
Direction by Dominique Lozano. I should have mentioned in the introduction that ACT has been doing this for some 42 years now in its second adaptation, which premiered in 2005, and an adaptation by Paul Walsh and Carrie Perloff. What is your, let's start with you, Catherine, what's your favorite aspect of this production?
My favorite aspect of this production?
Whether it's a moment or something they do on stage or with the scenery or...
Oh, you know, there's so much. It's like my sons would ask, what's your favorite color of the rainbow? I'm like, well, I can't have the rainbow.
Who's your favorite child?
No, that I can't. No,
that.
I'm kidding. you get along with some people better than others, even if they're children. Anyway, I think, you know, I love, I'm only out there in the second half. Right? I love listening to it. I love hearing how each Scrooge, whether it's Anthony or Jimmy, how they're tracking. I'm in the dressing room putting all my glitter on, you know, and listening to how tracking their Scrooginess, right, and listening to it and what I'm coming into. Whenever I can hear them, like a laugh will escape them involuntarily, and I just mark it. I'm like, ha-ha, I counted three laughs. He's mine tonight. But I think my real favorite thing is when I watch that last song being sung and that final moment, and the curtain comes down, then I watch all the actors go off and shake themselves off to come out for curtain call. And it's just such a behind-the-scenes moment that this you can hear the audience on the other side of the curtain.
Roar.
And something really lovely has been shared with 1,000 people. I'm just so humbled to see all those folks, because I'm up there getting ready for my curtain call, to see all those folks walk off with a good day's work done.
Mm-hmm. Caleb, it's a show, as you've learned, it has to be 110% each time. What's your favorite moment in the production?
So I'm gonna,
other than Fred, we got Fred out of the way.
Exactly. Now, I'm gonna cheat a little bit. Because there's kind of two things that I really love about it, and that's I also love the end. So I just kind of want to, because if everything goes right, then the audience is transformed along with Scrooge. You know, that's, for me, that's the goal of the show. And so whenever that works, I love that moment. But every night I wait for Ken Ruta to come out as Jacob Marley, and it's my absolute favorite. It is, because, I mean, he is a living legend, and that scene to me is the distillation of what is trying to be done in this story to
Now,
Scrooge.
You're talking inside baseball here. We should let people know that he's playing the ghost of Jacob Marley.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes. So. You know, and I, you know, it's early on, and he has my favorite line of the play, and it's early on, so I feel okay saying it, but, you know, he says, you know, mankind was our business, you know, mercy, charity, benevolence was our business, you know, the dealings of our trade was just a drop in the comprehensive ocean of our business, and I just think about that every single night, that's the way we should think about it, is that, you know, we're here on this planet with each other, you know. And I can't speak highly enough of that. That's my favorite.
Oh, that's very sweet. Are you one of those lucky actors that is going to be earning their equity card, or you ever have that in the bag?
No, I am one of the lucky ones, you know, getting off of this show, and I just feel blessed to be to do that, you know, especially with these amazing actors around me.
Mm. Caleb Lewis, Catherine Castellanos, we wish you a wonderful run, and the spirit of Christmas remain with you.
Thank you.
For a run of ACT's production of A Christmas Carol. 22 more opportunities to catch it before it closes on the 29th. A tremendous production directed by Dominique Lozano, and based on the original direction by Cary Perloff and adapted by Cary Perloff and Paul Walsh. It's Dickens' A Christmas Carol at ACT, act-sf.org for more information. Catch it if you can. Great segue from A Christmas Carol would be to let you know about some of the other wonderful holiday events that are happening here in the Bay Area. Things that we didn't have time to fit everyone in on today's edition of Open Air. We'll have some more for you next week live in studio. But permit me to offer some suggestions here for what to do in these next couple of jam-packed weeks here in the Bay Area with holiday events. Well, Mittens and Mistletoe is back with a winter circus cabaret. SweetCanProductions.com. It's their ninth annual version of this cabaret. It's a Bay Area holiday favorite. more comedy, spectacular circus feats, and interactive madcapery. This year's cast includes veterans from Circus Bella, the New Pickle Circus, Cirque de Boheme, Ars Minerva, Flynn Creek Circus, and Teatro Zenzani. You'll have a great laugh and see some amazing works of acrobatics and fun times. Through the 30th, productions start on the 26th, actually, the day after Christmas, and then there are 2, 4, 6, 8 additional performances, 9 in total. Sweet Can Productions for more information. The San Francisco Symphony continues the tradition of presenting classical music associated with the Christmas season with performances of Handel's Messiah this Friday and Saturday, with Jane Glover conducting the San Francisco Symphony and Chorus and Handel's glorious masterpiece. Then on Sunday at 7:30, members of the San Francisco Symphony Brass, Percussion, and Timpani sections, conducted by Edwin Outwater, present a mix of classical and popular holiday favorites in Holiday Brass. Also at Davies Hall, it includes screenings of Christmas-themed films, continuing their screenings with live-to-picture performances. On the 19th to the 21st, Randall Craig Fleischer leads the San Francisco Symphony and Chorus, joined by the Ragazzi Boys Chorus and Young Women's Choral Projects of San Francisco, and Chris Columbus's beloved holiday comedy, Home Alone, featuring the music of John Williams. And then to round out the year, on the 31st, conductor Edwin Outwater leads the San Francisco Symphony in New Year's Gaiety, a fabulously festive evening featuring famed drag sensation Peaches Christ, comedian vocalist Jane Lynch, vocalist Cheyenne Jackson, actor-singer Varla Jean Merman, violinist Thorgy Thor, vocalist Brianna Sinclair, the Homophonics, an affiliate of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, and members of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. That's a way to spend your New Year's Eve. For all of these things that are happening at the Symphony and their various smaller ensembles, go to sfsymphony.org. Holiday announcements after our next segment with our regular contributor, Peter Robinson, with some film diversions for us. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Yes, good to be here. And I was just thinking early on when you were talking or interviewing performers for Scrooge, that if you are going to ACT, a good reading tip ahead of time is an edition of Christmas Carol, and it's by W.W. Norton. And what is interesting about this publisher's version is we have the regular story on the left-hand side of each page, and then on the right-hand side is Dickens' own handwritten version of Scrooge, along with corrections, words he'd changed. And I think it's a great treat to read the book aloud, maybe with friends, with family, with children, because you do get that sense of the rhythm of how he constructed it, and then you have got the manuscript on the right-hand side of how he actually wrote it. So that's Christmas Carol.
Indeed. Have you seen the display at the Morgan Library in New York?
I have, some time ago when they first started producing.
Yeah, it's well worth a visit, especially to see that actual book, that one of the versions that he actually did some of those scribbles on. That's a great, great suggestion, though, Peter. Thank you.
So this week, the two movies I'm looking at are in different ways stories about three queens. They are both set in the 16th and the early 17th century, and I found myself asking the question, what do we learn about history, or what do we learn about history today when the story of the movie is set some 400 years ago? Because I found with each of these, the first is The Favourite, and the second is Mary, Queen of Scots. I found with each of these that the contemporary issues of feminism, childbearing, the status of women, the question of dynasty or dynasty, as we say over here, were all focal center points of these two stories. So although you're getting history, you're getting it with a contemporary twist or a contemporary interpretation. So I'm going to start off with Queen Anne, who's played by Olivia Colman, who actually played the real queen in the series The Crown. And she, in this role, she is a genuinely dysfunctional monarch. She is essentially guided, directed by favourites, hence the title of the movie, The Favourite. And in this case, it is the Duchess of Marlborough, a really tough role, a manipulator, played by Rachel Weisz. And gradually, this role of The Favourite turns into a role where the favourite is rivaled by a younger and prettier one, played by Emma Stone. So we're looking at a monarch in the early 17th century. It's very much a costume drama. The sets are great, and they use a wide-angle lens to take in what looks like the backdrop of Blenheim. And again, the male characters of fops in long wigs, essentially on the side, but effectively manipulated by the women. Now, I asked the question, is this more a contemporary movie about the Me Too movement today? Because when you go back into the history books, the way the story is told is through the eyes of the Duke of Marlborough, who, of course, is the husband of the Duchess Sarah, and he is there fighting major battles in Holland, in France. So he is a general who was abroad, whereas this movie focuses on life at home during the reign of Queen Anne. And she is indeed a very eccentric monarch. She does have 17 miscarriages, but part of her eccentricity is at least 17 different rabbits who run around the whole of the court and get as much of her attention as ruling the country. Now, if you put it into sort of poetic terms, you may remember that the great poet of this period was Alexander Pope, and he found plenty to satirise. And in a sense, this is a movie of satire. There was one line where one of the ladies, the senior sort of duchess, turns to one of the fops and said, would you like a bite of my new maid before you leave? And you're left there gasping and wondering, is this what England's come to now? So we move with the second movie back in time, and we're now in the period of the early 16th century. We're actually in Scotland. The movie's title is Mary, Queen of Scots. And this is very much a tragic, tragic tale. Mary, at the ripe young age of 18, finds herself widowed. Her husband, who would be the future King of France, is gone, and now she returns to Scotland. And Scotland, in these particular periods, is a very, very unruly place. So, again, we're dealing with an issue, and I use the word queens because on the English throne at the time is Queen Elizabeth. So, again, we're looking at the years roughly in the early to late 16th century. Elizabeth dies in 1603. And the way the story goes in the film, it was pretty accurate to the history in this case. Mary, Queen of Scots, ends up marrying Lord Darnley. He is a Catholic in a Protestant country. Her subjects don't like him. He is murdered. And as a result, she has to flee the country and throws herself on the goodwill, if we can call it that, of her cousin Queen Elizabeth. Now, I mentioned both the word dynasty or dynasty and childbearing. Elizabeth is the Virgin Queen. She does die in 1603. She never does have children. Mary has one child who indeed will become the future King of England, James I of England, James VI of Scotland. And of course, I don't think it's a spoiler, Mary, Queen of Scots, will end up having her head cut off at Fotheringay Castle in 1587. Now, when I was watching this film, I kept on thinking, this really is the subject for an opera. And in fact, an opera was written about it. It's called Mary Stuart by Donizetti. And in that sense, a full tragic life, I think, is sometimes better explained in music than necessarily on the screen. But there are some fine acting parts. Robbie Morgan, the woman from in The Wolf of Wall Street, plays Queen Elizabeth, and they do a remarkable job with makeup. Queen Elizabeth's face is white, and this is the first interpretation I've seen where this is to cover up the fact that she has smallpox. So we're looking at a story where rivalry between kings and queens, or in this case queens, the issue of dynasty, and at the same time the question of religion. A Protestant queen challenged by a would-be Catholic contender. Now, the film does not go into all the plots, which, of course, is almost a story in its own right, to put Mary on the throne, but you get that sense, deep sense of rivalry. I think it's a film worth seeing. It is a tragic film, and a couple of the lines stood with me. One line, I was jealous. Your beauty, your bravery, your motherhood, you seem to surpass me in every way. And this, indeed, is Elizabeth speaking to Mary. Now, in real life, they never actually had that encounter. They did not meet. And again, when we look at movies as history, that's what I call poetic license. And when I finally looked at movies as today, one of the key lines, and it's on the movie's poster, is bow to no one. So Me Too is alive and living. It's alive and living at the court of Queen Anne. It's alive and living in Mary, Queen of Scots. And they're both playing here in the Bay Area, for those history buffs who want to see how history can be retold by movie makers.
Thank you, Peter. What are some of your favorite things to do here in the Bay Area for your holiday experiences?
Yes, I've got the Nutcracker lined up, if for no other good reason than the music. Yeah, I love, I'm a romantic at heart, and I think just to see the dancing going with the music kind of brings the story to life. You mentioned briefly Dickens in relation to Scrooge. Now, in several different places, there is something called the Dickens Fair going on, and this is very much a costume party if you want to take the time, dress up, and head out and enjoy all the good cheer of Christmas. So those are a couple of things on my upcoming agenda. And again, I go with the old British tradition. I eat turkey at Christmas.
not a goose, okay. Thanks, Peter, and happy holidays to you.
And to you too, David.
Well, speaking of the Nutcracker, we're hearing a little bit in the background. You have some 30 more opportunities to catch it at SF Ballet before it closes on the 29th. sfballet.org. Speaking of other events that are going on and of great dance, Smuin Contemporary Ballet is not to be missed for their Christmas ballet. They're kicking off the holiday season with the return of the Christmas ballet. It's a beloved Bay Area tradition which features two very different acts packed to the brim with both flawless classical ballet and red-hot contemporary numbers. It's celebrating the company's milestone silver anniversary, and this 2018 edition of the Christmas Ballet will include many original pieces from founder Michael Smuin, plus two festive world premieres, a beautiful new work by Rex Wheeler, plus a pas de deux by Erica Felsch set to the classic Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. If you've never been to the Smuin, well worth it. The first act, Classical Christmas, will feature dancers in snow-white costumes performing traditional holiday favorites such as Smuin's Bach Magnificat, wonderful to see danced, and Wassail, as well as Amy Seiwert's Caroling, Caroling, Bright, Bright. This year, the company also unveils a world premiere from former dancer Rex Wheeler, as I mentioned in the first act, a classic bravura duet for two men. Also, come the second act, it's Cool Christmas with a hot, red-hot costume change and features a spirited medley of contemporary festive numbers. Once again, Smuin dancer Erica Felsch will Unwrap, a joyful new piece set to the classic tune Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, also on the Bill Smewen's iconic Santa Baby, featuring the world's longest feather boa. And my recent talk with Celia Fushil revealed that she was the first performer of Santa Baby some years ago. And you'll catch a cameo by Elvis in Blue Christmas. Hula dancers, surfboards, and Christmas Island, and some fun surprises at the Smewen Ballet. You'll really enjoy the performances. SmewenBallet.org for more information. Across the ballet, the performances are going through the 24th, by the way, for that. SmewenBallet.org. Across the bay in Oakland, our friends with the Oakland Symphony and conductor Michael Morgan presents Swing and Soul, Let Us Break Bread Together. Michael Morgan's inspired multifarious musical bash takes its inspiration this year from the peerless soul of Nina Simone and the boogie-woogie of Fats Domino. Special guests abound in this annual rollicking holiday party. The concert features Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir, Mount Eden High School Concert Choir, the Oakland Symphony Chorus, and more. That's this coming Sunday, December 16th at 4 p.m., oaklandsymphony.org for more information. The Golden Gate Men's Chorus presents its annual holiday concert, Jingle All the Way. They'll experience a three-decades-long tradition of one of San Francisco's finest male choral ensembles as they celebrate shimmering winter anthems, joyful carols, and sentimental holiday favorites. They're fresh off a first-place win in the Llangollen International Music Eisteddfod Festival in Wales. And they're raising the bar yet again this holiday season, featuring intricate works by Bach and Monteverdi, as well as some favorites like Bing Crosby's version of I'll Be Home for Christmas. Those concerts tonight at 8 and continue through Tuesday the 18th at 8 p.m. Information at ggmc.org. Speaking of great men and the great singing they do, Chanticleer presents its beloved annual holiday tradition with an offering of sacred music from the Renaissance and joyful spirituals and traditional carols in some of the Bay Area's most ornately decorated missions, churches, and cathedrals. They'll be at St. Ignatius for performances that start tomorrow night at 6, 9 additional performances, chanticleer.org for more information. Music also by Svelink, Rachmaninoff, and Poulenc, traditional English and Spanish carols as well. A Chanticleer Christmas, chanticleer.org for more information. Enough with the men singing, you say? Well, here's an opportunity to catch the San Francisco Girls Chorus as they return to the aforementioned Davies Symphony Hall for their beloved annual holiday extravaganza. It's a long-standing tradition in the Bay Area's festive concert schedule. They'll present a special evening of traditional and holiday music from around the world, featuring world-renowned special guest artists, the Kronos Quartet. That performance is on Monday, December 17th at 7:30, Davies Symphony Hall, sfgirlschorus.org for more information. Cherish the old, embrace the new. Speaking of women singing, the Young Women's Choral Projects of San Francisco's Winter Showcase features all four choruses of the organization singing solo and together with harp and cello. Music by Benjamin Britten, Handel, DeLeibs, John Rutter, and David Conte's new piece for the premier ensemble with cello and piano in addition. The Women's Choral Projects of San Francisco is going to be at Calvary Presbyterian Church this coming Sunday at 4 p.m. YWCP.org. for more information. A jam-packed weekend. It might be a wet day, too, Sunday, so prepare some extra time as you're traveling to your event of choice, and you should no excuse for staying home. Don't let the rain keep you down. Bay Area is abounding with wonderful holiday opportunities, including Sunday's concerts at the Presidio Chapel. This one's called Ring in the Season. Featuring Rachel Payne, mezzo-soprano, as well as Dion Nielsen Price, composer and pianist, and the San Francisco State University's 12-handbell ensemble. It's at the Presidio Chapel this coming Sunday at 4 p.m. as well, and it's free. Information, go to thepresidio.org for information that's happening in the Presidio area. Well, I mentioned the Messiah in Davies Symphony Hall with the San Francisco Symphony Chorus Friday and Saturday at Davies. You can also experience Handel's Messiah in Grace Cathedral tonight at 7:30, Friday at 8 p.m. The Majesty of Grace Cathedral is quite a setting. It's perennially a sold-out event, so you'd want to get some information soon. It's with the American Bach Soloists under the direction of Jeffrey Thomas. The Opera News wrote, Jeffrey Thomas draws crisp, a vital playing from the ace Baroque instrumentalists of American Bach soloists. And soloists abound for Handel's Messiah and Grace Cathedral, AmericanBach.org for more information. Let's go out this week with an aria from, actually a chorus from Handel's Messiah, the wonderful For Unto Us a Child is Born. We'll try to include some of the links to these things on our website at klw.org. Search for the open air link, and we'll have some wonderful events for you to attend yourself. The wonderful music of Handel rounding out this edition of Open Air. Thanks so much for listening. A reminder that our shows are archived at klw.org, and we'll have links to all of the events that you heard mentioned today before the day is out, I would say. Don't go there too soon. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. Sarah Cahill will be your guest host next week. I wish you a very happy new year and holiday season as it progresses.